Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, North Korea threatens to scrap the Korean War truce. Sanctions against North Korea show China has had enough. Kiribati is embarrassed because some North Korean officials received passports from that Pacific nation. We have this and much more coming up. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The international community is organizing to punish North Korea for its third nuclear test, with the United States and China supporting tougher sanctions against the isolated nation. They've drawn up a draft UN Security Council resolution. North Korea has anticipated the international action, and in response, Pyongyang is threatening to scrap the truce that ended the Korean War in 1953. Brandon Trembath has this report.
Nearly a month after North Korea conducted an underground nuclear blast, a plan to punish the nation is taking shape. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is Susan Rice.
North Korea will be subject to some of the toughest sanctions imposed by the United Nations. The breadth and scope of these sanctions is exceptional.
She says for the first time, the illicit activities of North Korean diplomats will be targeted, and there'll be new travel restrictions. North Korea's sole major ally, China, has tentatively agreed to the planned sanctions. Susan Rice expects them to be broadly supported.
And we hope for unanimous adoption later this week. Obviously, in terms of implementation, this is something that has been a very important part of the United Nations efforts and the efforts of member states who have imposed these sanctions in the past.
Before she confirmed that the U.S. and China had agreed to a draft United Nations Security Council resolution, North Korea's state-run news agency said the nation would nullify the armistice that ended the Korean War. The White House spokesman Jay Carney says threats from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea are not new.
Well, the DPRK will achieve nothing by threats or provocations, which will only further isolate North Korea and undermine international efforts to ensure peace and stability in Northeast Asia.
By chance, a congressional hearing on North Korea has been taking place on Capitol Hill. Elliot Engel, a Democrat from New York, is the ranking member at the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Pyongyang poses a serious threat to the national security of the United States and our allies in the region.
The congressman recently visited Asia to speak to top leaders in Seoul, Tokyo, and Beijing. While he says North Korea's missile and nuclear tests are well known, he says less attention is paid to the wide range of illicit activities it's engaging in to support its military program and leadership.
The North Korean regime's criminal conduct, including drug smuggling, weapons trafficking, the sale of nuclear and ballistic missile technology to rogue regimes in Iran and Syria, and the counterfeiting of U.S. currency, cigarettes, and pharmaceuticals, serves as a lifeline to keep itself in power.
Elliot Engel's recent Asian visit did not include a stop in Pyongyang. Very few Americans have gone there, but the flamboyant U.S. basketball champion Dennis Rodman has. And he got to know the leader of the reclusive country, Kim Jong-un.
He wants Obama to do one thing, call him.
He wants a call from President Obama?
That's right. He told me that. He said, if you can, Dennis, I don't want to do war. I don't want to do war. He said that to me.
He spoke in an interview with George Stephanopoulos of America's ABC network. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has dismissed the visit as a stunt. He says, as a diplomat, Dennis Rodman is a great basketball player.
As we just heard in that report from Brandon Trembath, North Korea has threatened to scrap the Korean Armistice Agreement following a deal between the United States and China supporting tougher sanctions against the country. China is North Korea's closest ally and has a history of resisting tough sanctions against it. So how will these new measures impact their relationship? Joanna McCarthy speaks next to Dr. Broman Dalton, a Korean specialist at the University of Technology in Sydney.
Yes, I think this is the key part of the story, is that China is actually conceding that some action has to be taken. They must read that they have concerns with their relationship with the new leader, and it's time to remind the North Korean leadership that there are certain limits that can't be pushed.
Indeed, and some of these measures appear to be perhaps curious, there's an explicit ban on luxury goods like yachts and racing cars. Is that the kind of thing that's really going to make a difference?
Those sort of things will always get through. But what is significant is that these sanctions are aimed at turning off the tap, if you like, because a significant amount of resources that fuel into keeping the elites happy and loyal to the leadership are raised through illicit activities. So North Korean, and using their diplomatic connections and business connections, they have been tied to distributing counterfeit money, to running guns, running drugs, and accumulating large accounts in places like Macau. We've already seen those accounts frozen for some members of the extended regime, but this will hurt the hip pocket, if you like, of the Kim, the centre of the family, to use their largesse to maintain loyalty.
And it does seem that the past sanctions have done very little, almost nothing, to really rein in Pyongyang. Is it time for a broader, new approach?
What we've seen is an increasingly hawkish approach to dealing with relationships with North Korea, and you know, looking at more sanctions. We've got a long way from the days when engagement was the preferred mode under what was known as the Sunshine Policy, and really there is very little evidence, in fact much evidence to the contrary, that this hawkish sanction type approach with North Korea is working. If anything, there's been heightened tensions, and of course North Korea has acted out with their various missile launches. So really, I don't know whether going even further will improve situations, and some creative thinking really needs to be taken on the other side of the ledger around engagement.
And of course now we have North Korea threatening to tear up the armistice treaty. They've made these kind of threats during periods of high tension before. Can we assume that this is an empty threat?
Yes, well, we should never make any assumptions about North Korea, and they are now a nuclear power. The other factor is they have a very young leader who's proving himself. He might be more vulnerable to being controlled by military forces, or it's not as clear where power resides. And you know, usually Asia have very sort of often octogenarians running their regimes. Just the generation that now is in control in North Korea, I think, is a concern when they start with this bellicose language.
And what about these allegations we heard in Brendan Trembath's story earlier of counterfeiting, drug smuggling, arms sales? How much real evidence is there that this is what the regime is engaging in?
I think that the United States is fairly confident about the extent of the sort of nefarious activities, if you like, of the North Korean regime. They closed a big bank account of Kim Jong-un's older brother, who's a major business tycoon and was running those accounts. They've been aware of the CIA and other auditors in the United States have been looking at the flow of cash around these. Even in Australia, when we had a ship, the Pong Su, it got it was impounded here in Sydney Harbour, and they were found to be the so-called North Korean officials were found to be trafficking heroin. There's quite a few cases, and I don't doubt the evidence.
We now move to a story that we covered a few months ago concerning North Korea. Among a number of countries caught up in North Korea's alleged illegal money-making activities has been the small Pacific island state of Kiribati. Last year, a North Korean company that the UN said was a front for illegal arms shipping reportedly was sourcing passports for its operatives from a number of small nations, including Kiribati. So did they or didn't they sell passports to North Koreans? Richard Erwart asked the president of Kiribati, Anote Tong, this exact question.
We did sell passports to Chinese, but at the time it was as a means of generating revenue. This was done in the in the 1990s into 2000. When we came into office, when I came into office in 2003, we canceled that program for the reason that it was not very popular. We did not believe it was the right thing to be done. But I think that angle with the involvement of North Koreans and particularly with potential terrorist connections was something that we never intended to happen, nor did we expect that it would happen. We are embarrassed by this, but I can assure you that we had corrected that situation in 2004 when we stopped issuing these passports. We came as a new administration, we came into office in 2003. And in 2004, we canceled all of any issuing of those passports, which are sold to many foreign nationals simply as a means of generating revenue. And so that's gone. The discovery, I think, is just what remains of that. In fact, they should have been, the passports should have been invalid at the time they were discovered.
So presumably it came as much of a surprise to you as anyone else when this story broke.
Well, definitely, and they would have been left over. Remnants of what was part of the passports that were issued in the 90s and early 2000s.
And that was Anote Tong, the president of Kiribati, speaking to Richard Erwart. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. China's annual session of parliament got underway this week, and there are already questions about the country's growing military might. This week, at the Great Hall of the People in Beijing, the National People's Congress spokeswoman told the gathering media that China's growing military might was nothing for the world to worry about. But she did acknowledge that the Chinese government is facing tough decisions, especially when it comes to the environment. Stephen McDonald has this report from Beijing.
China's former ambassador to Australia, the charming Madame Fu Ying, is the new face of the National People's Congress. She's smooth, intelligent and urbane, and when in Australia she'd confidently stride into the ABC studios, knowing she could handle even the curliest questions thrown at her. But even for an experienced hand like Fu Ying, China is sailing into difficult waters. As official spokesperson for the National People's Congress, she held a press conference. There were all the usual details about numbers of delegates, the program and so on. But then came the questions. She was asked about China's military expansion and responded that this country's growing arms expenditure had contributed to global peace and stability. We strengthen our military power in order to protect ourselves, she said. It's for safety and peace. It's not to threaten other countries. This point, this principle, this policy, we've been firmly upholding them for decades. We've never altered from this path. In addition, our peaceful foreign policies and our defensive military standpoint have for this region's security and peace made great contributions. But a Japanese journalist from Kyoto wanted to know how China planned to resolve its escalating territorial disputes in the ocean, especially the rival claims to the Diaoyu or Senkaku Islands. And as we heard, this is a dispute which goes back a long way.
1898,
In 1898, Japan stole the Diaoyu Islands from the Qing Dynasty, she said. This part of history is clear. I really wish Japanese people would know about this history. She said that when the Japanese government took over the islands last year from a family, this breached a common-sense status quo, which had existed for many years and again inflamed the conflict over disputed ownership. Because this common sense doesn't exist anymore, China no longer has a basis for constraint on this issue, and as a result, our ships are now cruising around these islands. In the run-up to the Congress, one issue which has been very much at the forefront of ordinary people's minds is pollution. Air quality in the Chinese capital seems to be deteriorating again after some improvements following the Olympics. In the first months of this year, Beijing's pollution has hit record bad levels. Some are questioning whether all this economic growth is actually worth it if people's living standards can have been so badly affected by the pollution all around them. On the internet, they're even talking about China's toxic growth. Spokesperson Fu Ying had no choice but to acknowledge what a huge problem this is becoming for the government. Just like anyone, I'm also worried, she said. Every morning when I open my curtain, I look to see if there's smog. I have two masks, one for me, one for my daughter. But I haven't used mine. Maybe I don't want to be photographed in it, she joked. And there'll be plenty more to be said about these and other issues facing China over the coming week and a half.
And that was Stephen McDonald reporting from Beijing. The giant free trade agreement known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, took another step closer to reality this week. Japanese media reporting that leaders of Japan and the United States have reached a compromise to keep tariffs in place for the time being. This goes against the spirit of the TPP's goal of zero tariffs, but paves way for the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to finally announce that Japan will join the group. Karen Snowden has more.
When Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and President Barack Obama met in Washington last month, they discussed regional security issues, the containment of North Korea's nuclear program, and cars, a touchy issue. Barack Obama wants Japan to join the giant TPP free trade area currently being negotiated, but doesn't want to immediately eliminate the protection of the US car industry. Shinzo Abe has agreed to let the US import tariffs on Japanese vehicles remain for now, even though zero tariffs are the goal. It's a watershed moment, says Dr. Martin Schulz, the senior economist with the Fujitsu Research Institute in Tokyo. He says Mr. Abe is looking at the bigger picture of closer trade and political relations with the US and Southeast Asia.
For Japan, of course, the automobile sector is extremely important, but even more important for Japan is getting the economy growing again. So joining the TPP, reducing tariffs internationally, and getting some barriers internally lower is one of the most important projects, and the TPP is where the focus currently is on.
The US imposes low import tariffs on Japanese cars, just 2.5%, but it's 25% on trucks. Japan has no tariffs, but the US automotive industry says Japan imposes much tougher non-tariff barriers to keep US products out of Japan. In the give-and-take game of trade negotiations, Japan will insist US tariffs are cut to zero in future, in return for an agreement on the even touchier subjects of agriculture and the insurance market. Dr. Nobuaki Yamashita is from the School of Economics at La Trobe University in Melbourne.
Very political sensitive item for Japan for agriculture.
Dr. Yamashita says there's a groundwell of support in Japan for the active form of Abe economics, from a public tired of 20 years of stagnation and the effects of the 2011 tsunami.
So I think this is a golden opportunity for the government to announce the TPP joining, and if they miss this opportunity, you know, coming back.
How will the Japanese economy benefit in real terms, do you think, from its membership of the TPP, you know, once it's in place?
Real effect, it might not be much greater in terms of Japanese export growth, but there's a sort of a spillover effect, especially that since we don't have China on this TPP negotiation, if we can sort of forge much stronger trade link between Japan and US and some other country in TPP, then maybe 5 or 10 years down the track, maybe we can see spillover positive effect.
President Obama wants Japan in the 11-member TPP, along with Australia, South Korea, New Zealand and several Southeast Asian nations. As the third largest economy, its size matters. So does its role as a linking economy between the US and Southeast Asia, a $2 trillion market of 600 million people. Martin Schulz says for Japan, as well as the US, it's also about politics.
One important exception, and this is very important on a political level as well, is China, of course. So getting Japan on board is very important politically and in terms of economic volume, in terms of the impact of the TPP. On the other hand, it will most likely slow down the process significantly.
Shinzo Abe is expected to announce Japan will join the TPP by the end of this month, a decision delayed since 2011. Even Japanese farmers are said to be less negative about free trade these days as they eye expanding markets for their specialist sushi rice and other premium products, especially to, where else? China.
We now go back to Beijing. As we mentioned earlier in the program, China's parliament opened this week for a session that will swear in the new generation of leaders, including President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang. However, the complicated political culture of the ruling Communist Party, its 25-member Politburo, and the powerful 7-member Standing Committee may mean that much-anticipated reforms may come slower than expected. Sinologist Carrie Brown is a professor of Chinese politics and the director of the China Studies Center at the University of Sydney. He speaks next to Sen Lam.
Well, the tasks are the same as they were when reform and opening up started in 1978, and that is to continue delivering economic growth and lifting up the living standards of people. The issue, though, now is China has set itself, the government and the party, of doubling GDP within the next 8 years. So basically, per capita GDP now is about $5,000, $5,500 US dollars. And the aspiration is to have that increased to around $11,000 US dollars by 2020. So this will, in effect, make China a middle-income status country. In most other countries in which that has happened, that has led to some kinds of political, legal changes, social changes, has a very big impact, complex impact. And so in a sense, you can say that broadly, the party's commitment to economic development, while it remains very, very important, is going to have competing political, legal and social policy issues, which are almost certain to grow urgent as the years go on.
Anyone who's been to the big cities like Beijing and Shanghai will see the conspicuous consumption that China's economic growth is fostering, and yet the gap between the rich and poor is widening. How do you see this playing out under Xi Jinping's leadership?
The attempt to do something about inequality has been a constant issue for the last 15 years. I think the issue, though, is what do you do about it? You want people to unleash their entrepreneurial energies, obviously, and that's happening in China. You want people to have the economic freedom to do that. But on the other hand, you still have, according to the National People's Congress last year, 150 million people living in the Chinese definition of poverty, and maybe as many as 25 million malnourished. So you've got a country with lots and lots of wealthy people, but also a country with many poor people. I think the key strategy for dealing with inequality is going to be to try and build up social welfare, to address some of the big issues about the inequalities between the city and the countryside. China's urbanizing very, very quickly. It's already 50-50% for the first time in history. So really trying to build up the kind of social infrastructure that allows people to maybe, you know, kind of feel more secure, but also does something about the poorer people in society without access to public goods at the moment.
It's reported that outgoing president's protégés still dominate the current Politburo. Does that mean that Xi Jinping has to tread gingerly in terms of bringing about reform?
Well, he is one of a group of leaders. He's not an emperor. It's not like there's someone sitting at the centre with all power. Obviously, Xi Jinping is a critical person because he has the party leadership, he has the military leadership, and this week, next week, he'll get the presidency. But the constraints on him from other groups in the party, from just the inability to implement things in such a complicated society, it's not going to be a free run. It's not going to be an easy run. And basically, it's a question of prioritizing. Where is the place where Xi really feels he can place all of, you know, the kind of the concentration to be able to get consensus on a particular issue? We seem to have a mixture of people who believe in the role of the state-owned enterprises and feel that the state should still be running large parts of the economy, but also people who are maybe more liberal, like Li Keqiang, and believe in greater opening up. And so because this leadership is new, we really don't know the answer to it.
And indeed, I also read one of the reports that a group of industrialists from the private sector will try and persuade the party to push on with privatization. Is privatization of state firms something the party might actively pursue under Xi Jinping?
The non-state sector in China, the private sector, creates a lot of employment, a lot of innovation, and a lot of growth. The issue really is that state-owned enterprises have been big, big suppliers of profit, but they have become vested interests. They've become empires, political empires sometimes. So I'm sure part of their strategy will be, how do we deal with this? How do we continue to get good growth from state-owned enterprises, make them more efficient, and ensure they don't become overmighty? There are certain parts of the economy, the state-owned enterprises, energy and other areas, which it's not so easy to do. But there are some parts where you can really say, OK, we've got to marketize these. And that will be, I'm sure that will be one of the key battles in the years ahead.
As you say, China's leadership is pretty complicated. Much negotiation has to take place before any kind of change is implemented. How do you think this slow pace of change might go down with an increasingly youthful and well-informed Chinese population?
Well, it's going to be a very tough thing because their expectations are pretty high. They want the same things as consumers in the West want. They want the same public goods. They want the same security. And so they're going to be pretty demanding on their government. And in places like Shanghai and Beijing, they already are. How the government fulfills these expectations is going to be a huge, huge challenge. And we shouldn't underestimate the possibilities of there being major problems in the years ahead, and maybe quite soon, as some of this discontent and contention bubbles over.
And guess what? We're now out of time. Before we go, if you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. We're going to leave you today with a Taiwan singer by the name of Soda Green. The song is called That Moment Is Over, just like the show is. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.